Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Education in Renaissance Italy, this week on Soundings. My guest is Paul Grendler, a professor of history at the University of Toronto. Paul Grendler is the author of Schooling in Renaissance Italy, Literacy and Learning, 1300 to 1600, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Paul Grendler's book explores the content and methods of primary and secondary education during the Italian Renaissance, the kinds of schooling available, and the aims of education in Renaissance Italy. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Paul Grendler is working on a short history of Italian Renaissance universities. Here is Paul Grendler.
Well, let's only go back 400 or 500 years to the 15th and the 16th centuries. Let's call him Little Giovanni, who starts off to school in Venice. I like Venice. He goes off to school at about the age of 6, and there he learns the letters of the alphabet, syllables, and words. He learns the words basically through reciting aloud prayers, the Our Father, the Hail Mary, and so on and so forth.
No question about mixing church and state in these times.
Not at this stage, actually. There is very little religious education in these schools. It's just sort of assumed that because he's growing up in a Catholic city with a church on every third corner, that he doesn't really need very much grounding in the fundamentals of the faith.
Was he in school all day long? Let's be very particular for a moment.
Yes. Little Giovanni would go off to school shortly after sunrise, and he would be there probably until the middle of the afternoon. He would then go home, of course, and go back the next day, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, the most interesting thing about this very early stage of schooling is this. After the earliest stage of learning the ABCs and how to read, or at least to recognize some words, the school system split into two. I perhaps shouldn't call it a system. There are two separate streams. Let's keep Giovanni in the Latin stream. Now, let's assume that Giovanni is the son of a doctor or a civil servant, and his father and mother fondly hope that he will do the same as an adult.
Professional aims here.
Professional aims. Maybe go on to university. If he's going to do that, he must learn Latin. And so little Giovanni, at the age of 7, perhaps the next year, begins his training in Latin grammar. He continues in that same school at the same master, or he goes to another neighborhood school. A neighborhood school is nothing more than one man in a room with as many children as whose parents are willing to pay him for his services, and he begins his study of Latin grammar. A long and arduous study, I might add. He learns Latin grammar. Before long, he starts to study the Latin classics. That is, he might learn Virgil's Aeneid, Cicero's Letters, Terence's Plays, and that extremely boring book, Caesar's Gallic Wars.
Paul Grendler, let me ask you to pause for a moment. You're talking about little Giovanni here.
Yes, son of the civil servant or the lawyer.
What about little Maria?
His sister.
His sister, his cousin. Is she involved in this schooling?
Probably not. Now, what Maria will do is the following. First, if the family has enough income, they will hire a private tutor to instruct her. Now, the reason for this fundamentally is that they felt that going out into the neighborhood school and mixing with boys was not a great idea for little Maria.
They want to protect her.
Yeah, precisely. And Maria is, of course, a middle-class child whose parents have middle-class or upper-class aspirations. So if the family has enough money, they will hire a private tutor for her. This private tutor may not be entirely private. He may teach 4 or 5 little girls from 2 or 3 households come daily, and they'll all group together and they will learn. Or if that's not possible, she might learn from a relative, her mother, mm-hmm. an aunt, a grandmother, what have you, someone in the family.
What we would call what? Home teaching,
Home tutoring. Moreover, Maria's education was unfortunately limited and went into a different direction. She didn't learn as much in the vernacular schools as did her brother. She would learn how to read and write and a certain number of prayers, but she didn't get the practical training. She didn't get commercial arithmetic. She didn't get bookkeeping. The reason for this is society didn't feel that women should have practical roles. She wasn't going to stand up in the city council and deliver a harangue saying we should do this or that. She wasn't going to run the family business. Now, in practice, some women did run the family business.
There were many powerful women in the
Renaissance. There were many powerful women. If the girl is a princess who's going to become queen, she will then get the Latin classical education because she's going to be a leader. But most women did not.
Was there a feminist reaction to this form of discrimination, however subtle or overt it may have been?
There was a limited feminist reaction, yes. There were a few women who felt keenly this deprivation. Mm-hmm. And if they had the opportunity, they wrote about it and wrote about it in scathing terms. But of course, there aren't very many of them.
Does the figure of Kate in The Taming of the Shrew, how realistic is that? I'm not sure that by citing Shakespeare, we're trivializing or enriching this conversation about Renaissance education.
Well, she's a great character and it's a great play, but I don't think it tells us a whole lot about it. I'd rather talk about Elizabeth, or I'd rather talk about the widow of the merchant whose sons aren't old enough to take over the business and who does take over the business. There are some examples of this, and some of them did extremely well. They ran the business. They obviously had to have, and did acquire at least, the learning to do it.
Was there an assumption that women were fundamentally inferior, that they were, what, genetically or societally inferior? How do we account for this two-tiered double standard?
Some men of learning, I regret to say, did feel that, but the basic reason for not educating women as extensively as men was that they felt that this was impractical. They didn't need it because they weren't going to run the business or run the government. And since education costs money, why spend this money and have them spend years on these skills which aren't going to be practical? So again and again, the treatises say, a girl should learn how to be a good mother. She should learn enough reading and writing in order to instruct her children and so that she can read edifying literature. Little Giovanni studies the Latin curriculum. Maria is probably going to study the vernacular curriculum. In addition, another little boy who comes from working class background will also study the vernacular curriculum with a difference. Let me explain.
I'll call him Little Angelo.
Angelo. Let's call him Angelo. To go back just a bit, after learning their ABCs, which Giovanni and Angelo and Maria have all learned in one form or another, Angelo will go off to another neighborhood school in which he will study the vernacular curriculum. By that, I mean he is going to learn vernacular reading and writing. That is, reading and writing in the local Italian dialect, whether it's Venetian or Roman or Florentine or whatever.
He's headed toward a mercantile?
Yeah. He's going to be a merchant. He's going to work for a merchant. He might be an artisan who makes things or what have you. He's not going to be a leader of his city. He's not going to govern his city in any way, shape, or form, or serve it as a lawyer or high civil servant.
Mm-hmm. Paul Grendler, your description of these two tracks of education in Renaissance Italy, the vernacular on the one hand, the Latin on the other, did this not create, what, some social distance, resentments, problems, as it were, that would be the upshot of these educational systems?
It certainly did create social distance, because a boy who has spent years in the vernacular stream can't really change at the age of 12 or 13 to the Latin stream. He's already missed 6 years of Latin, and he needed an incredible capacity to read and to speak Latin to go on to university. It was very difficult for him to change. This inevitably tracked students at a very early age, and given their backgrounds, it meant that one group from the upper part of society, moved along the Latin stream and into commanding positions in society, and the others did not.
We're talking about foregone conclusions. The whole idea, you know, you see the TV ads, be all that you can be. That just would have gone right out the window, huh?
You had better be all that you can be at the age of six, or your parents had better decide what you're going to be at the age of six. Now, you can, of course, shift from the Latin to the vernacular schools without difficulty, uh-huh. because everyone learns local Venetian or local Roman.
Right.
But moving up the ladder was more difficult.
Who set this up? I mean, how do you figure out the game plan here in the sense of the assumptions that undergird the kind of education mm-hmm. that you're describing here for these children?
Society really sets up the expectations for Giovanni, who's going to study Latin. That is, society expects that he, like his father, is going to assume some leadership role in society. So he has to have that appropriate training. He needs this training, which is going to teach him how to be a good man and an eloquent man. A good man means civic as well as moral values.
Uh-huh.
They may not be ours, but at least they seem to make sense to them. Now, the obvious question is, why would Giovanni, in 1500 Italy, learn texts that were written in ancient Rome and Greece? And the answer is...
William J. Bennett was standing there asking him to return to the classics?
Well, that's another issue, which I probably shouldn't get into. The point I want to make is that Giovanni's parents, or his group, his part of society, firmly believed that 15th century and 16th century Italians were very much like ancient Greeks and Romans.
Mm-hmm. That was the model.
That was the model.
Mm-hmm.
And that education turned ancient Romans and Greeks into eloquent men and men who commanded the most powerful political force in the known world.
Even if they weren't necessarily what
right.
what these models purported them to be.
Education is always aspiration.
Uh-huh.
People always aim in their education for more than what they may actually be able to accomplish. What Renaissance Italy set up was a new system of education. That is, as I think I've written somewhere, education changes very slowly. There have only been a handful of curricular revolutions since the Greeks civilized themselves a long time ago.
You said that, what, these revolutions come along once every 500 years or so?
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The Renaissance overthrew a medieval system which was basically Christianity and logic in favor of a system which had more societal values, a greater emphasis on serving one's city, serving one's family, serving one's surroundings.
Did these Renaissance educators and the objects of the education that was offered to children, did they necessarily see that as kicking God upstairs, as a disservice to the religious dimension of one's life?
Definitely
the
not.
The spiritual dimension?
They saw it as supplementing it. They were not irreligious. They were not anti-religious in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
They saw this as providing supplementary moral training that is more appropriate for the marketplace, for the city council,
uh-huh.
and so on.
They were adding to and not detracting from.
Absolutely.
Why do we have such a terrible problem with this bugbear word humanism, therefore? There's lots of ways to load that question,
yeah.
but let me ask you to comment on that.
Because some people in the 20th century, dare I say this, who know very little history, have redefined the term humanism.
Mm-hmm.
What they're talking about is secular humanism. On the one hand, there is the group of people who advocate a philosophy which excludes God, and on the other hand, there are religious groups who see them, perhaps who see this kind of secular humanism infecting a vast part of today's society. I
mm-hmm.
think they're both quite wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they're right or wrong, neither of them really relates very well to the Renaissance.
What would be the modern counterparts to these stages that you've been describing, Paul Grendler? Are we talking about vocational schools, tech colleges, high schools, liberal arts colleges? How do the parts sort of shift and blend together?
There isn't an exact counterpart because it was a very simple system.
Mm.
Giovanni and Angelo went to school starting at the age of 6 or 7 and continued up to about the age of 16. They might, of course, drop out earlier, particularly if they're going to enter the workforce. They might drop out at 12 or 13. Giovanni, who's going to go on to university, would probably stay in school till about 16, and then he would go off to university. But there isn't really any alternative. It's a unitary system. There's no real distinction between elementary and secondary. The curriculum just gets a little more complicated, and some of the texts remain the same. After all, you can study Cicero on several levels, and he is a difficult text.
So I'm not sure that you want to call it progress necessarily, but at least we have, what, a richness, a plurality to our educational apparatus that that does not have a counterpart in the Renaissance. You mentioned the word texts, Paul Grendler. Let's talk about the administration of these schools. Who picked the books? Who set the agenda, as it were? Were there equivalents of what we would call modern-day educational administrators?
Not at all, or only in a very limited sense. Either teachers or parents picked the texts. Parents or teachers first.
PTA.
Nope, no, there's no PTA. What happens is that the neighborhood schoolmaster, this independent master, simply sets up shop in some corner property and teaches the children in the neighborhood, chooses the text.
Surely not self-proclaimed. He has the endorsement of the community and the parents.
No, he's self-proclaimed. Remember that the parents pay him for his services. If they don't like his teaching or if he beats the children, they can take their little boy to another school, because there are maybe 250 across the city of Venice. Each is independent. Each can do as he or she pleases. There are a handful of public schools in which the master is chosen and paid by the city government. Mm-hmm. But there are only 10 or 12 in this large city of Venice. Venice in the 16th century had 150 to 175,000 people, which is, by the way, more people than it now has on the islands of Venice.
Goodness. What about the issue of discipline, Paul Grendler? How did these children react? Are there written records outlining what happened to kids who misbehaved?
There are a few written records. They don't tell you a whole lot. But by simply picking up stray comments here and there, I think I have an idea of what happened. The old notion that children were beaten into learning Latin grammar or whatever it was is simply not true. Corporal punishment certainly was used for disciplinary problems, the boy who misbehaves. It was not used, so far as I can tell, to force children to learn. Now, there are a handful of exceptions to that, but basically that wasn't done. And again, it makes sense. I mean, why would you pay good money to send your son to a master who's going to beat him?
Was there a dropout problem? have you been able to
That's
nail that?
That's very hard to determine. All I can do is tell you what it is at one point in time. I can't tell you who dropped out the year before. Mm-hmm. There simply aren't the records. Because there's no education bureaucracy, there are no records.
What about physical education? Did the secondary educational system in Renaissance Venice have a football team? A soccer team, not a football team.
Soccer team. No, they did not. That simply didn't exist. And the reason for it is most of these schools were one teacher and 25 or 30 or 40 pupils. You can't have much of it of different ages, from 7 to 15. You can't have much of a team with that kind of student body.
Paul Grendler, today kids in education, what we have all these horrible statistics. They spend jillions of hours in front of the television set and dozens of hours in the classroom. Was there a Renaissance counterpart to that sort of problem? What kind of literature or culture did children consume?
There was, to a limited extent. The pop culture of that society was chivalric romances. That is, these vernacular stories in which the knight and the lady go off and slay dragons, and the villain and the knight rescues the lady and marries her and lives happily ever after, until in the end the arch-villain kills him. But of course the son of the knight carries on the story.
And today we call them situation comedies.
Yes, or adventure stories. They're really adventure stories, sometimes with a love interest, sometimes with a very good love interest. These were taught in vernacular schools. I've thought about that. There are no records to tell me why, but I've thought about it, and I think I can answer the question why.
What was the aim?
These were the texts of the people. These were popular literature for the people. And I have run across documents in which the teacher says, well, I teach chivalric romances because the students bring the books to school. The parents want me to teach these texts, meaning that the parents enjoy these books. Books are a scarce commodity. They expected and wanted their sons to read these books as well. One teacher simply sort of shrugs his shoulder and says, well, I teach to the satisfaction of the fathers.
I see.
So these were part of popular culture, and then they migrated from popular culture into the schools. You have to know the background. Chivalric romances were extraordinarily popular. They started off as stories that minstrels told.
Oral literature.
Oral literature. Mm-hmm. The minstrel would have regular hours in regular places, and he would come there, right, maybe with his mandolin or whatever, and would tell his story. And he attracted enormous crowds. And these stories, of course, go on for days.
And somebody finally decided to write it down.
Eventually, people wrote them down. They ended up in books. They got printed and eventually migrated to the schools.
So for us to dump on popular culture and to look back at the Renaissance and say there was no such beast is really inaccurate.
Well, yes and no. There are good chivalric romances and terrible chivalric romances. Generally speaking, the better ones ended up in the schools.
They helped to socialize these children after a fashion.
And they helped to teach them to read. They're good stories. They literally are.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Paul Grendler. We're talking about your book, Schooling in Renaissance Italy. I'll invite you to step onto a sheet of thin ice here. Was it a better educational system than what we experience today? Goodness knows we have lamentation throughout the land constantly about education in America. Do we look back and find, what, a better or a worse example there?
Let me preface this by saying the reason I think there's such a debate now about education. This system, this Renaissance system, lasted for about 400 years. It didn't really break up until World War II, after World War II in Italy. That is, until that point, there was a two-stream system for the children of the elite and all the others.
Latin and the vernacular.
Right, which was based fundamentally on the classics. Now, what happened over time is that vernacular classics were added, science was added, and so forth. By the time you get to the 20th century, a great deal of that integral core is gone. It tends to lack its reason for being. And people eventually noticed that. It started to break up in Europe about the time of World War II. In Italy, not until 68, by the way, 1968.
The time of the riots.
The time of the riots, and only at that time could an Italian schoolboy or girl go to university without having umpteen years of Latin and Greek. Now, that system is pretty well gone in most people's minds, but we haven't come to a consensus about what the new system should be.
We're on the cusp of one of these revolutions that you've described.
It's very possible. Except I don't know how it's going to end. My guess is we're going to opt for eventually some training that's more analytical in nature, but that's only a guess, and historians are notoriously poor prophets. Let me add to that. Renaissance education served the practical needs of Renaissance society. People felt it was very useful and necessary to learn how to write Latin prose, because many people did have to write Latin prose in official capacities, as secretaries to the government, as an ambassador to the Pope, or whatever it happened to be. Latin was the international language of diplomacy and technical communication. Even Newton, in the 17th century, wrote his major works in Latin.
This was a kind of an infrastructure.
It was the language of learning.
Sure.
So it was very practical, as well as imparting values. That side of a classical education is gone. One no longer has to write a scientific treatise in Latin. One no longer has to communicate with another state in Latin. So that part of it has gone. In the Renaissance, it was both practical and, they thought, taught boys and girls how to be good men and women.
And by comparison, education in the United States in the late 1980s, we've moved quite a ways away from that sort of an ideal.
We have. One of the reasons why that it's so difficult to design education for today is that there's no vast consensus among the population about what basic civic and moral and religious values are.
Our plurality, it looks like it's going to do us in somehow or other.
I don't think it's going to do us in, but it means that somehow we have to design an education that takes into account those realities. Uh-huh. I think Renaissance education took into account the realities of that day very well.
You sound enthusiastic, Paul Grendler, when you talk about Renaissance education. Would you send one of your kids to a school such as this in contrast to what the schools now offer?
Yes, I would. I think it would be good for them. I think they would enjoy it enormously. After they got over the hump of approaching these texts very thoroughly. It's very hard to sit down and really learn a text, and the language and everything comes after it. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure today that my son and daughter should learn Latin. I think it's terribly important that they learn languages.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Paul Grendler of the University of Toronto. Paul Grendler is the author of Schooling in Renaissance Italy, Literacy and Learning 1300 to 1600, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Paul Grendler is at work on a short history of Italian Renaissance universities. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 445. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about music and ethnomusicology in the Yemen Arab Republic. My guest will be Philip Schuyler of Columbia University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in April marks the anniversary of the end of the American Civil War, when Robert E. Lee surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia on April 9, 1865. The founding of the Mormon Church dates back to the second week in April, 1830, under the leadership of Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. Booker T. Washington, the black educator, W.C. Fields, the movie actor, William Wordsworth, the English poet, and Thomas Jefferson, America's third president, all have birthdays during the second week in April. Booker T. Washington in 1856, W.C. Fields in 1879, William Wordsworth in 1770, and Thomas Jefferson in 1743. Finally, the second week in April is the anniversary of the announcement in 1955 that declared the Salk vaccine against poliomyelitis to be safe and effective. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Education in Renaissance Italy, this week on Soundings. Listen for Paul Grendler of the University of Toronto. With an eye to the controversy over the aims of education today, Paul Grendler explains the content and method of primary and secondary education during Renaissance Italy. How did little Giovanni and Maria read, and what did they read about? Schooling in Renaissance Italy, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.